The following is a North Carolina Baptist resource. For more, visit ncbaptist.org.
Today we're going to be talking to you about life, life communities, living an intentional faith every day. That's kind of the point of the whole thing. I don't know how many of you have been involved in the pockets of lostness throughout our state, but this came as quite a shock to us. We live in what would be considered the Bible Belt. I mean, there's a church on every corner, and you know that. And it was just so stunning to us to see that 45,000 people out of a community of 125,000 people were designated as lost. In pocket 60, we're talking almost 35-40% of the population has no knowledge of God. And our hearts were broken. And we immediately thought, well, you know, we got to do something about this. This is ridiculous. This can't be going on like this. And so what we began to pray about when John came to share these things with us, I can remember the very first meeting at Lakeview Church. And I remember the Lord just speaking to me so clearly. He says, Stephen, I've got enough churches. I need more disciples. I got enough churches. I need more disciples. The truth is, disciples make disciples. And so he began to really burden me. John and I have been working together, and this is one aspect of our strategy. It's a much larger strategy for reaching that lockbox of 60. But this is one that kind of fits into every church and every place that I pray the Lord will be able to encourage you in. It's called Living an Intentional Faith Every Day, or Life Communities. It's just that. It's an intentionality. It's not something additional. We're not looking to add something to the congregation. We're not going to add another program to your church. We're asking to be intentional about living your faith every day. And in so doing, began to reach the communities that we're living in. The truth is, today, I want to answer the question, why life communities? You've been to 100 seminars on things to help you and the church grow and all that stuff. And I know that. I've been to them too. I've been a pastor of the same church for 25 years. And it's dying now slower than it ever has. And it's really doing great. No. And so these communities are, the concept here is the reality that every person has that opportunity. Every family has that opportunity. So today we're going to be looking at really kind of the reasons why we need something different than what we have. Why we need something that's not like what we've had before, something quite different, and something I think you can embrace pretty simply. We live in a new culture. It's a new culture for us that many times I think we're completely unaware of. Connie?
Welcome to the minority. How many times have we even thought of ourselves, but probably the past 10, 15 years, we're dwindling down far and far further in being the minority in our culture. For conservative Christians, a psychological adjustment is taking place. In a de-Christianized culture, it becomes harder to imagine yourself part of a moral majority. It was never quite true, but now with the decline of casual Christianity, it is incredible. So how do 62 million evangelical Christians and other theological conservatives, not a majority but a significant minority, view themselves in their cultural role? Now, this was in the Washington Post by Michael Gerson, and he would not be a conservative and he would not necessarily be a friend of the church, but this is an incredible truth. Just an incredible truth that is true, okay? And we look at the de-Christianized culture, and what exactly does that mean? It means that we do not have influence in our culture. We do not have that influence anymore. If we look at our schools, where do we see Christ in our schools? Where do we see prayer in our schools? And these are our children. This is our next generation. And it's non-existent. And then for the decline of casual Christianity, you know, it used to be that we had people come to the church. I mean, look at funerals anymore. How many people do you ever even come to a funeral, you know, where they come to see their friend? But look at our churches. It's just not having people come to see, okay? They are not there. So then as we look at it, the last one, as we view from the cultural role. We look at ourselves as there is one chair at the table. We are just one of the chairs at the table vying for their interest in what we're doing. We must prepare disciples for this new culture that we are in, that we are the minority. Chris Schofield, that is doing the prayer ministry for this state, says that we are in a spiritual famine and we must return to God. We must return to God. And so that is our very heart, that this is where we are right now, and we need to seek God, and we need the people who are ready to engage people.
We're looking at a new paradigm, a different way of thinking. I've been a pastor for 30 years, and I went to Southeastern Seminary back in the 80s, and the truth is we've always been taught that one method of going to reach the lost. And we guys that always in this go therefore make disciples, but the truth is we really are about coming and seeing us. We always say we're going to go see the lost, we're going to go do this, we're going to go do that, but the truth is churches are built upon the idea of come and see what we're doing. Come and see our special event. Come and see our programming. Come and see what we got for your kids. Come and see what we got for your family. Come and see what we got for your seniors. Come and see what kind of music we play. Everything is built upon a come and see. So when we started thinking about how do you reach 45,000 people that are in an area no bigger than a county, I mean, my goodness, we just build a bigger church, wouldn't we? I mean, we just keep building a bigger church and a bigger church, more programming. Is it working? Are we really reaching? Are a lot of people just storming into your church on Sunday morning? Most of the time it's folks you already knew, and there are folks who have been there last week and the week before and the week before. And I can say that because I've seen it over 30 years. It used to be a lot of lost folks came to church. And the truth is, if you'd have revival, we've seen 45 baptized in 1 week in revival. But anymore, if I had a revival now, we'd be lucky if we got the people there. It's the come and see model was a wonderful model when culture was on the side of Christianity. When everybody kind of agreed Christianity was a good thing, it worked real well. But what we have found is when we plotted the members of our church, we found out they live in the pocket 60. Our church is not in the pocket 60, but our members are. In fact, almost half of our members live in the very project that we're trying to reach. The truth is they work in Project 60 or Impact 60. They work in the very location. They live and they work right in that vicinity where they go to church 15, 20 miles away. So the new paradigm, instead of come and see what we're doing, is let's go and serve those who are in need. Let's go meet our neighbors. Let's go meet the people who are a part of where the Lord has planted us. You know, we're very big on the sovereignty of God. Well, you didn't just buy that house on your own. You didn't just put yourself in that place. God had you located there where you're located for a specific purpose. And the project of Life Communities is about how do I become influential in the lives of the people in our community. So there's a new strategy involved, a new strategy called discipleism. Now, I know when you saw that on the sheet, you thought I just misspelled discipleship. No, it's called discipleism. And it's a wonderful word. It was coined by Alan Hirsch and in a little small book he wrote. It's a wonderful book. It's online. You can get it really easy, like four chapters long. Discipleism is changing our strategy about how we're reaching people. It's not changing the fact that we're reaching people for Christ. It's not negating the gospel message. But it's about growing in relationship with people. How many of you remember the Engle scale? Y'all remember from seminary? Did you ever look at that? It's a wonderful scale. It's really interesting. It starts down here where a person has no awareness of God, and it moves up to some awareness, contact with Christians, moves on up, accept the implications of becoming a Christian, then decision about receiving Christ, coming to know Christ, gain confidence, on and so forth, so on, ongoing growth. This was developed to show that discipling doesn't start after somebody comes to know him. For in fact, if you look at the lost, in 1980, the vast majority of people you ran into when you went out visiting or went knocking door to door, I've done it. How many done CWT? Knocking door to door, man. Chris Schofield and I, we came to a house, and oh my gosh, it was pouring the rain. Now, Chris is a really tiny guy, you know. And myself, we're standing in the alcove of this door, and we knock on the door, and the lady opens the door, and she screams and slams the door in our face, "Get out of here, you perverts!" Well, I'll never forget that. We did not lead that lady to Christ, let me tell you. Prior to 1980, most people, they knew what the truth about gospel was. They knew the message. They had been to church. If they hadn't been to church, they'd been to a wedding, they'd been to a funeral, they'd been somewhere, and somebody had shared with them the good news about Christ. But maybe not everything, just about church. You just knew church was a good idea. It was a good thing. It was something that's right. But now, after 2000, this is where you're going to meet most people today. They may have some awareness of God, but their God isn't going to be the same God you're thinking of. And the reality is we're living in a post-Christian society. We're more like the early church in a pluralistic society than we ever are like the church was in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s when my uncle pastored for 60 years and it was blowing and going. It was wonderful. But now you're just one chair at the table. We don't control the table. We don't demand of culture. We have no support from culture. And so what we saw was that the people you're beginning to meet are going to be people here, not here. So it's a vastly different process. Now, if we were looking at evangelism, everything that happened before a person makes decision, we would say is evangelism. And everything that happened after this, we would say is discipleship. But discipleism says, no, the whole thing is discipleism. I should know you the moment I meet you. I should be on this trail to take you to the next level with Jesus Christ. If we were to look at this, we're no longer searching for the one and done. CWT, it was the one and done. And it worked. I'm not saying it's not a good idea. I'm not saying you shouldn't learn EE and all those things. We have certainly learned the Romans Road and all those things. But the truth is, it was geared to a one and done thing. I'm going to meet you one time and I'm going to lay it out for you. The power of the Holy Spirit's going to come and you're going to be converted. Well, that was great if the person had any knowledge that a Bible was true or that the gospel was a good thing. But when you meet a person who has no knowledge of who God is, you're starting from a point where nobody even knows what you're talking about. You're talking about something they've never even looked at, may have never seen a Bible. We have children that come on Wednesday night for our backpack ministry, and many of them never seen a Bible before, had no idea what a Bible was. And it's a marvelous opportunity, but it begins the moment I meet you. No longer are evangelism and discipleship two different terms, but one process for bringing someone from not knowing to knowing. It's discipleism. It's the whole thing. The moment I meet you, the first time I meet you, I need to begin the process of moving you along that continuum of understanding who Christ is. It begins the moment we meet. Our goal that every person we meet will know more about the Lord than before we met. You know, one of the things about CWT at EE and all the knock-on-the-door evangelism that we used to do, it's pretty rewarding when somebody comes to know Jesus, isn't it? But it's pretty defeating when they throw you out, isn't it? The truth is, there are not many victories in it. If you went and looked at all the percentages, you see there's not many victories in it. The wonderful thing about this is it's an encouragement. If I can get my neighbor James to know a little bit more about Jesus than he knew before, a little bit more about my faith than he knew before, an honest assessment of it, it's a far greater victory because I'm going to be in a relationship. He's my neighbor. I'm going to be beside him as long as he lives there, which, seeing James, he'll live there the rest of his life, and so will I. It's no longer just about a singular decision, but a long-term, this is really important, a long-term servant relationship that ultimately leads to a relationship with the Lord. And this is, if there's one word that or one phrase that kind of summarizes life communities, it's a servant relationship. That's where we come from. That's the direction we're looking to go. But to do that, our people need to be trained, the people that go to church with you, the people that are in your fellowship, in your Sunday school, in your classes, in your discipleism group, are going to have to learn a new language. Just like we had to learn a new language all the time in the different programs that we've been given over the years, this is one called gospel fluency. And if there's one thing that missional community has given to the church greater than any other gift, it's this concept of gospel fluency. Now, I don't know whether you're familiar with that. I don't know. There's three different aspects of it. One comes in conversation. There's a gospel fluency of conversation. There's a gospel fluency of conversion. and there's a constant fluency of conviction. So I want you to take a few moments just to look at that. Jeff Vanderstelt, who's probably one of the most well-known of folks that deal with missional communities and has been a great inspiration for us, gospel fluency is speaking the truths of Jesus, that is the gospel, in the everyday stuff of life. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to carry on a conversation that wasn't out of the ordinary? A conversation that didn't seem stilted or didn't seem directed or contrived. Wouldn't it be nice just to carry on a conversation? To know that in doing so, you're raising that person's knowledge of Jesus Christ along that scale. Well, gospel fluency in conversation is one of the most interesting. This came as a great shock. Everybody has a gospel. I didn't used to believe this, but everybody has a gospel. After doing this for years, I can tell you everybody's got a gospel. I don't care who they are. They can be as lost as a goose in a snowstorm, but they have a gospel. They know, one, how they got there. They may think it's goo to you. They may think it's creation. They may think it's just somebody from outer space planted seeds here on the planet. But everybody knows how they got there. How this is happening. They've already thought. Now, they won't tell you that right out in everyday language, but once you get to know them, they'll be glad to share it with you. I remember Kyrie Irving says the world's flat. So they'll let you know. The fall. Why it's not going so well. You ever met a cab driver who couldn't tell you why it's not going so well? I don't know why they don't run for president. My goodness, they always seem to know all the answers to the problems of the world. So everybody knows why it's not going well. Now, they don't know the truth about why it's going well, but they've got a gospel in their mind that says that they know that. The third thing is redemption. They know what'll fix it. You know, if everybody just was educated, we'd be all right. If everybody wasn't out of poverty, we'd be good. You know, if the government would just be fair, we'd be great. Everybody has a gospel message, and ultimately, they know what it's going to look like when it gets fixed. Yeah, we would all be even. We'd all have the same stuff. We'd all be doing the same thing. Because every person has to think these things in their lifetime. Where did I come from? Why isn't this going well? What would fix it? And what's going to look like when it gets done? So what I want you to do is I want you to listen to this next gentleman. You'll recognize him right away. And I want you to think about it. I want you to listen with gospel fluency. I want you to listen for what he would say is his gospel message. Okay?
When I was young, I was very lucky. My parents bought me books, encouraged me to learn new things, sent me to a very good school. And so I got to think about science and scientific discovery. And in fact, right about that time, the very first computers came along. And so I was very curious to play with it. In fact, my teachers found it confusing, and so they let me run with it. I even ended up teaching the other students about the computer. So I got to dream and see something that would really be different and amazing at a quite a young age. Well, I feel incredibly lucky that my success at Microsoft created something of economic value, and now I have the responsibility and also the privilege of working with my wife Melinda to make sure it goes back out to the world to buy vaccines, to make contraceptives available, to advance science, mostly to help out the poorest in the world. And so I'm loving that work. I feel like my work at Microsoft trained me for this phase, and now it's us as a couple doing this together, and that's what I'll be able to do the rest of my life. I always knew that I didn't want to be running a technology company in my 60s. I wasn't sure when I would make the change. In fact, I turned over the CEO reins back in 2000, and it was about 4 years after that that I decided that I did want to shift, and so there was a four-year period before I actually made that change. It's a huge change, but I got to use a lot of the skills I had then. I've gotten a chance to learn new things. My wife is a wonderful partner. It's fun to be doing it together. I'm certainly an optimistic person. I have dreams about my kids growing up and doing well. I have dreams about eradicating polio, that you know every woman who wants contraceptives has access to that. The foundation has very ambitious goals. We're trying to virtually eliminate children's deaths, and we can make some really incredible progress on that if we do our best.
So, what do you think his gospel was? Huh?
Humanism,
science, education, eliminating poverty, eliminating death, wealth. You see, in just a few moments, he begins to share everything that's important to him. One of the most important things about, first of all, learning about gospel fluency is learning how to listen. We're all about telling. That's, you know, we're going to come and tell you about Jesus. We're going to tell you about the gospel. We're going to tell you about that. The truth is we need to learn to listen. We're not demanding the table anymore. We have to learn to listen to folks. And when a person shares with you their heart, you begin to hear where their gospel lies, not so that you can argue with them over their gospel, but to see the connections. Like when Paul was on Mars Hill, he says, "You've got a God over here you don't have a name for. Let me tell you who that is." They had already agreed there was a God that had no name. They had already agreed that there was a God that had no name. Now he was about to give him a name. It's really important that we learn to listen. So one of the first steps is learning how to listen with a gospel fluent voice. What is this person telling me about what they believe? What is this person telling me? Because what they believe is where you need to meet them. Not what they think about, not what they may say, but what's in their heart. The second thing would be that of conversion. We've edited the gospel over the years down to you're a sinner, get saved, come know Jesus, get saved, live a good life. The truth is, in our society today, that's not a big enough gospel. It doesn't tell a person where how they got here. It doesn't tell a person why they're in the predicament they're in. Why is it going so badly? Why is this world going so bad? Well, it's fallen. You didn't know that? I mean, it's fallen. The world is fallen. It's not ever going to go well. It's always going to go badly. But most people don't do that. They think it's going to be getting better as it goes along, the evolutionary thought. So you've got to be willing to expand your gospel to share. When looking for a decision rather than a relationship, we shortcut the message. I want to be your friend. I want to come to know you. I want to be your buddy. I'm going to be your buddy whether you ever come to know Christ or not, because you're my neighbor. And the Lord said I'm supposed to be your friend. And so I'm going to do it, but I need to know that in that process, I'm giving you the whole story. How did we get here? How did this happen? Why is it going so bad? And then the message is best received when it's accompanied by a servant. Jesus taught us that over and over and over again. The message is best served by a servant. If I'm a servant of the Lord and I'm a servant of the person that I'm trying to have that relationship with, my message is going to be far more intensified toward them, far more influential in their lives. And so it's really important to understand this gospel fluency is about learning how to hear the gospel message in conversation, to lead to conversion, and then ultimately to bring conviction. Sometimes we think the gospel message was just about getting saved. The gospel affects every aspect of your life. There's nothing goes on in your life that the gospel is not affecting right now, that Jesus is not involved with. And so we've got to remember that many times we have to reintroduce Jesus to other believers. Have you ever had a believer who just went off the deep end like I do every once in a while? My wife has to pull me back from the edge. And you're going crazy. And she'll say, "What are you worried about? You don't have to be in control. God's in control." That's the gospel message. God is in control. But I forget. I think I'm in control. And suddenly I start losing it. I have to be reintroduced to the one who saved me. My wife says, "You remember what Jesus told you? You're not in control. He's in control. God is glorious. I don't have to fear." How many times we get fearful, anxious? Jesus said, "Be not anxious." Why did he say that? Because you were going to be anxious. And so it's important to know that the gospel message is as important to believers in everyday life as it is to the person coming to know Christ. Many times we've forgotten who he is, that God is good. So I don't have to look elsewhere for other things. I don't have to look for approval from other people. God is glorious, so I don't have to prove myself. He's already approved me. He's already shared with me. So gospel fluency is about training people to begin to listen for the gospel message, carry on that conversation, leading to conversion, and ultimately to reintroduce people to Christ through the conviction that comes in the Holy Spirit. But there's also a new perspective on things.
We look at the new perspective in Luke 10:29. I'm going to put that up there. And it says, and who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? What have we as Baptists, how many of you have gone on a foreign mission or a home mission trip? Just about everybody in here. How long were you there? 3 weeks? 2 days?
2 weeks.
2 weeks? 10 days sometimes? You know, just depending. But then we come home. And how long has it been since you've been on one? You know?
July.
You know, but we don't always go back and see those or keep in contact with them. So we're looking at this. We love home missions. We love foreign missions, okay? We've been on them and we love them. And I'm not putting them down at all. But who is our neighbor? Who is our neighbor? And our neighbor, Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And this is the great and foremost commandment. This, the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets, from Matthew 22:37-40. Okay, when we look at that, like it, we look at love your neighbor as yourself. It comes from plaision, from the Greek, and from pelos, and it means near or close. What are we going to see neighbor as near or close? Are we going to see our neighbor? They're near us, aren't they? They are close. Think of the influence that you would have on your neighbors that are around you. Okay? Let's look at this next one then. In our zealousness to evangelize the world, we forgot to love the ones that lived right around us in our own neighborhoods. Most Christians could not name all the people who live in the 8 houses closest to their own home. Try it for yourself right now. Draw this on a little piece of paper, whatever you have. You're going to look at the 8 people that are around you. You're in the middle. Who's behind you? Who's on the side? Who's the front? Can you give me their names? Not that you have to give them. Can you write down their names? Can you write down their children? Can you write down what their work is? We are to love these neighbors with all our heart, with all our soul, and with all of our might. Do you even know them? The influence that you can have. What about their kids? What about their struggles? Do they know that they can come to you for prayer or encouragement? The neighborhood that we are in right now, we have been there almost 4 years, and we started this within our own neighborhood. There are 20 homes in our neighborhood. And these are people, so many of them have lived there for a long time, and they weren't even speaking to each other. And we had a cookout at our house. We had everyone come, and we said, bring a dish, you know, of anything, whatever you want, bag of chips, it doesn't matter. Just, you know, bring something. Not everyone came, to be honest, but of those that we came, and they sat, and they talked. And our neighborhood has been such a sweet and loving neighborhood since then. If something happens, there's like 6 neighbors down there to see what they can do. If there's a birthday, we had a little thing where they could sign up their telephone number and their birthday and things like that. And if it's a birthday, we'll go and we'll tie a balloon on their mailbox, you know, happy birthday. And just little thoughtful things as you take a waiter, okay? When you're at a restaurant and a waiter is there, what do you want them to do? Do you want them to sit down and talk to you all the time? You're there for them to serve you. right? So they're attentive to bringing you your drink, bringing your meal, or if you need some extra salsa, or, you know, whatever it might be. They're attentive to you. And you are the servant in your neighborhood to go to these people when you see that they need something. One day our neighbor that he referred to as James, right beside us, he was not friendly at all. Grumpy, just not friendly at all. His wife was very friendly, but he just was not. And so he was raking leaves one day, and Stephen went over and just joined in raking leaves with him. And he was, you know, and then Stephen was raking leaves, and he came over and he started raking leaves. And now they're just, hi, how are you? And they talk, and it's just, you know, just from that simple thing, a relationship was started. When there's a death in the community, of just taking some food to them, just whatever, just looking to see, what can I do? What can I do? What can I help with? So being that servant, loving your neighbor is not just attempting to lead them to Christ, but becoming the servant that the Lord asks us to become. Servanthood is the one descriptive term that best describes the role we are to strive to obtain. Okay? So a lot of times we don't want to be treated as a servant, but to be a servant is what we've been called to do, to serve. And I just encourage you to have that servant heart, just to be open and see your neighbors, going around just meeting them, just talking to them if you don't know them and what's going on in their lives at this point.
Why do we need life communities? Well, we live in a new culture. We're the minority now. We're bringing our thoughts to the table. We're bringing our arguments to the table just like everybody else. We have a new paradigm. It's not to come and see anymore. It's to go and serve. We have a new strategy that we're able to go out and be able to share this good news through gospel fluency. A new language and a new perspective on being servants. Now, the point of these communities is they're not all alike. They don't all work the same way. Yours will work completely different than ours will. But there's a way to begin. And so we offer the opportunity for a weekend for us to come and do a seminar for a weekend to be able to go through these four sections. There's two on Sunday, two on Friday night, two on Saturday morning, to get people started. And it doesn't take a lot to get started. Begin praying for your neighbors. Find out who your neighbors are, that you'd be able to name them. Right now, to be able to name my neighbors, it was a big thing for me to finally be able to do that. So we want to be able to help you accomplish that. This is not adding something more to your church. This is doing the norm. They're going to live life in the rhythms of life. We eat, we play, we drink, we eat, play, sleep, and work. And we're going to do all those things. Your families are going to do all those things. We just wanted to be able to do with an intentionality of being a servant to their neighbor so that they might raise them up on that knowledge of who Christ is, and then ultimately have the joy of seeing them come to know Christ. But even if they don't come to know Christ, be an influence for Christ in your community. There's not anybody in our community now that doesn't know that we are about Jesus. We're Jesus people. But the truth is, it wasn't that way when it started. It takes a while. It's slow. It's not going to be fast. You're not going to have 1,000 conversions. You're not going to have everybody coming to church with you next Sunday. But the truth is, you're going to be more influential in your community than you've ever been before. And so we just want to encourage. We offer that seminar for you to encourage you. Today we just want to kind of share why we would do that, and hope that it's something that would encourage you or something you might be encouraged in. Are there any questions that you have? Yeah.
At your seminar, Pray for every
home, yeah, and bless every home. There's two of them. These two books we also rather encourage you to get. This is Saturate by Jeff Vanderstelt. This is an excellent topic for missional communities. And the other is The Art of Neighboring by Patrick and Young Runyon. This is an excellent book, How to Be a Neighbor. And you can see the little picture there. It's the same thing. And these two books are real helpful, but we'll bring those with us when we come to the thing so that you can have them. But it's a pretty simple process. This is not rocket science. But it is a real change in the way you think about your life. When I think that I walk out my door every day and that my influence for Christ with my neighbors is the most important thing I can do, it changes everything about it. I used to go home, pull up the drawbridge. Now I go home and watch and see who's out in their yard so I can go by and say hello. Because I know them. If I walk up to James, hey, James, say, hey, Steve. I mean, we know each other. I know he's a big Penn State fan. He's miserable. God, he's so miserable. He is heartbroken. And I only jab him a little bit about it. But, you know, the truth is it's so different. Linda and Ken across the street have become great friends. They partnered with us in doing these things. They're Lutheran. You're going to have a lot of folks in your community that are of other faiths, but there are going to be other denominations, and you want to bring them right in, make them a part of it, be a part of this thing. It's a really wonderful thing. I just want to encourage you. There's some information, I think, in the back that has, if you want to call us about coming or being a part of it. I know John Gordy will be more than happy to encourage you in that. We've just been real blessed in it. It is not quick. It is not fast. It doesn't happen overnight. But it is very rewarding. When I first had that thing, Name Your Eight Neighbors, and I thought, oh gosh, that's shameful. I've been to Africa, I've been to Europe, I've been to Asia, I've been sharing my faith, and I don't even know the guy that lives behind me. I literally do not know his name. It really brought a conviction in my life because Jesus, the word neighbor is near. It's not far, it's near. So I just want to encourage you in that. Thank you all for taking time to come be with us. We certainly appreciate your investment in the time. Have a wonderful evening.